Hi, this is Byron Richards, and you are tuned into my weekly wellness update podcast, bringing you the health news that you can use. Well, as always, we've had another busy week in the world of health. There's just no way I can keep up with all the possible health news, so of course I select articles that I like for one reason or another. And we'll start out this week with a posting on Tylenol, linked to high rates of asthma in children. This is a broad study. Over 300,000 children participated in filling out questionnaires and whatnot about what's going on with them. It involved children from around the world. And one dose of Tylenol in the past 12 months in a 13 or 14-year-old was associated with a 43% increased risk of developing asthma. And those using higher doses, at least once in the past month and or more, had a whopping 240% increased risk of asthma. Wow. Tylenol, a lot of people just think that because it's been around for so long and has been on the market, it must be safe. Of course, many know that if you combine Tylenol with alcohol, you run a very high risk for injuring your liver very seriously. So it's not a trivial medication. But what we're seeing here is that there are a lot of shades of gray between drastic liver injury and malfunction of systems in your body. So what does Tylenol do? Well, when it's operating, it uses up the key antioxidant enzyme system in your liver called glutathione. It really depresses that in the as the quote-unquote price you pay. Now, once you deplete glutathione, then your cells and your immune cells don't have a proper defense to tolerate stress and deal with whatever chores they might have to be doing. And this leads then to operating inefficiently. And of course, allergies, asthma, immune system dysfunction, but in this case, kind of an exaggerated, inappropriate, inefficient response to something that results in a breathing problem. Because your body's antioxidant system isn't working right, seems to be what asthma does. Even one dose of it is capable of inducing this in a child, and multiple doses really are capable of inducing it. The good news is, of course, that Tylenol can be offset by taking the amino acid N-acetylcysteine. N-acetylcysteine builds up cellular glutathione. You can't just take glutathione. Glutathione, if you take it as a dietary supplement, it will work in between your cells, which is better than nothing, but that's you actually want it to also get into your cells, and glutathione doesn't cross cell membranes, so you actually have to build it inside each cell, which means you have to feed cells the things that help make glutathione or sustain its function. So N-acetylcysteine is a primary amino acid. Other ones that help a lot are lipoic acid, vitamin E, vitamin C. These are involved in recycling glutathione. But, of course, N-acetylcysteine, if you went into the emergency room with a Tylenol overdose, that is what they would give you to counteract the ill effects of Tylenol. So the take-home message here for parents is that if you're, for some reason, needing to use Tylenol, especially more often than once in a blue moon, you had better make sure your child's antioxidant system is up and running and replenished with N-acetylcysteine and other antioxidants, or you could be having your child's immune system learn inappropriate lessons, and they're more at risk for developing asthma. Now, of course, Tylenol isn't the only cause of asthma, but it is clearly one, and this isn't very good news at all for the pharmaceutical world that loves people to be dependent on their compounds, because this one's in widespread use. This is a huge public health problem because we have an epidemic of asthma, and we have lots and lots of people taking Tylenol. So consumer beware, and parents especially beware of this. You know, I mean, obviously sometimes you need something for pain beyond just nutrition for some people in certain situations, and nutrition can quite thankfully offset the ill effects in most cases of the use of this particular common medication. Okay, DHA versus diabetes drugs. Did you balance your PPAR gamma today? Well, I thought I would write an article. We're seeing, of course, that the commonly prescribed diabetes drugs, Avandia and Actos, which are now proven to break your bones and cause heart failure, yet they're still, especially Avandia, is the worst case for heart failure, but both of them will have problems. Avandia is just worse. Still on the market, the FDA's been recommended to drastically curtail it or remove it. They're still, quote-unquote, thinking about it while they twiddle their thumbs. They hate to confer legal liability to a drug company that knowingly injures and kills Americans. The FDA is a puppet of profits for drug companies. The FDA is slow to act, partly because they approved the dang thing in the first place, knowing it was going to cause problems. DHA activates the same gene signaling system that Avandia and Actos activates, but doesn't have any of the side effects of the medication, so I consider this a good learning point. The PPAR stands for peroxisome proliferator activated receptors. These are essentially proteins within genes. They're transcription factors. In other words, they receive a signal and then they go and do something. They bind onto the DNA, and then that tells the DNA what kind of messengers to produce, called messenger RNA, and those go somewhere else in your cell and tell your cell how to behave. So this is very powerful stuff. This isn't like something, you know, in the old world of drugs, a drug just sort of glopped onto the outside of something and poisoned it, and the degree to which it was poisoned, it was poisoning cellular function, was sort of interfering with something, and that was its therapeutic value. Now we've got these drugs that go into cells and start going and getting involved with gene signaling system. Avandia and Actos are two of these expensive drugs that do this kind of thing, and they are targeted at the PPAR receptors within fat. That is what their goal is, because when you activate these things in fat, first of all, you get new fat cells, which, you know, may not sound like a good idea to you, but actually the new fat cells are more metabolically functional, so they actually make more adiponectin, which helps with insulin resistance, and they, in theory, can store and release fat better. Compared to some of your old fat cells, which may be metabolically sluggish and unable to release their contents. And while new fat cells in a healthy person are always a good idea and they're always happening, in somebody who just keeps on eating, your new fat cells just fill up with fat anyway, so it's kind of a wash. But the point here is that, yes, you can manipulate some blood sugar numbers by stimulating the production of new fat cells. And that's one of the things it does. And so this ends up lowering insulin resistance, lowering triglycerides, and boosting HDL, which in theory, all of that sounds wonderful. These drugs can change those numbers and change some of that function. DHA does the exact same thing. But then we get to this other side of the coin. You say, well, at what price do these drugs do this? Well, they stress out your liver, your kidneys, your bones, and your heart. Because when you take a sledgehammer to a gene and force it to behave a certain way, you never know at what point you're not forcing it to do more than it would like to do on its own if it were consulted. And so what happens here is you actually have PPAR gamma receptors in your heart. And they are behaving according to a different set of rules. But the drug isn't differentiating between the ones in fat that they're wanting to manipulate and the ones in your heart, which are different. Now, in your heart, you burn fatty acids for fuel. It's a primary fuel source. And when you take these drugs and force the level of PPAR gamma high in the heart, you make your heart store fat, not get rid of it, store it, so your heart becomes fatty and swollen, and you make your heart burn sugar instead of fat, which is like making it feel like it's a sprained ankle, except it's a sprained heart. So no wonder there's a 40% increased risk of death of heart attacks from Avandia. because they're directly interfering with cardiovascular function. So while it sounds good in marketing promo that they're raising HDL cholesterol, because everybody knows that's good and protective of the heart, they're directly stressing the living daylights out of the heart. Yet doctors keep giving this stuff out to people, even though they're getting fluid retention in their legs, swollen legs, muscle aches, infections, all this horrid stuff from these drugs. This is considered standard medical care. Yes, be sure to consult your physician and ask them what the risk-benefit profile is, because they're surely going to give you just a wonderful take on how bad your diabetes is and why you need to take this medication that stresses the living daylights out of your body while it's lowering your numbers. So DHA, which does the same benefits but doesn't have any of the risks. Well, why doesn't it have any of the risks? Well, this is the point I'm trying to make. DHA behaves differently in your heart. While it can activate PPARA gamma, it's only consulting something. It's not forcing anything. So when your body has DHA present in your heart, it actually strengthens your heart and drastically reduces cardiovascular disease risk, which has now been proven by hundreds of studies. So it's a completely opposite effect, because DHA was there during evolution, and your body uses it all over your body for different things in different places under different conditions. But DHA doesn't force function, it just has to be there so function can occur naturally. This is the difference between drugs and nutrients. Nutrients consult, drugs force. And of course, bottom line of all of this is, if you want to activate the PPAR gamma naturally to break down weight loss, you just have to eat less food. Even worse, if you take a drug to activate this and you eat more food, where are the calories going to go? Because putting them into fat is a defense mechanism against too many calories. If you can't make fat out of these things, now what are you going to make out of it? The sugar is going to stay elevated all over your body and actually make you far worse. So, the science on this is clear, that the drugs are really quite dangerous, even though they can manipulate numbers, because they change things elsewhere in the body, the unintended side effects which are present in every drug case. The problem is, of course, that the FDA and the drug companies aren't telling people, and even the doctors who might study this for themselves don't quite understand what they're doing and don't cite the risks. They just cite inflated, ridiculous benefits. So I review in this posting all of the science on this and explain it in even greater detail. But the bottom line is that the DHA, which is so vital to the diet and has been a key part of human evolution, whether it's in your fat, in your kidneys, in your liver, in your brain, in your muscles, in your heart, your body knows what to do with it. It's not just the DHA accumulates in your cell membranes, which it does. That's very important to cell membrane electrical potential and cell membrane health. But once it's there, the DHA, we now know, based on this new gene science, is activating genes that are aiding the survival of your cells. And it's going to do it differently depending on the different places in your body where it is. This is truly remarkable. And that is what the new gene science is proving. The absolute remarkableness, if that's a word, of nutrition to benefit human health. It is just mind-boggling what is going on these days. All right, next study, waistline clearly linked to mortality risk. Well, this is not the first time I've covered this topic. But I thought this study was interesting because, A, it's in United States citizens, over 100,000 of them, men and women both. And yes, obviously, if you're really obese, you have double the rate of early death. That's not news. But what was kind of interesting about this is that even if your normal body weight for your height, if you're developing a stomach bulge, which has to mean that if you have more weight in your stomach, you have less muscle mass elsewhere. That's how you would develop and have a normal body weight. In other words, you'd be weaker and losing some muscle and replacing what you should have as muscle with belly fat. You have, if you're a woman, a 25% increased risk of early mortality, even though your normal body weight, simply by having a little belly bulge. So that's not good. And that just emphasizes the fact that abdominal fat in any amount is really not good. I mean, we know, for example, other studies have shown that if your waistline in inches is more than half your height in inches, so if your waistline is, you know, 30 inches and you're 60 inches tall or 5 feet tall, and you have a waistline of 30 inches, 5 feet, hold on a second here, 5 times 12, yeah, that's 60. All right, so in my little example here, that would probably be a woman, and if you are 5 feet tall and your waistline is 30 inches, you're accumulating inflammatory damage that clearly leads to heart disease. But this study is saying that even if you're normal, just above, even if you're normal weight with a belly, you've got a problem. So the waistline measurement, flat is best, and you want to do everything to trend in that direction. And maintaining a trend of progressive shrinking of your belly over time, even if it's slow but steady, will take you out of risk category because you're creating the dynamics that move it in the right direction. If it stays the same or is getting larger, you are taking years off your life, so don't do it because it isn't worth it. All right, let's see where we're going next here. Muscle fatigue is a superior way to build muscle with exercise. Well, I thought this study was pretty darn interesting because for years, of course, we've been told that if you want to build muscle, you really have to push it. You have to get yourself in shape. And then you have to do relatively low repetitions, 5 to 10 repetitions at a time. And you're going to lift 80 to 90% of what you could lift one time. And you're going to really tire out and push those muscles. And that's fine. I don't have any problem with anyone who wants to work out that way. But my point about that is, especially as we get older, but even for younger people, but especially as we get older, you get injured really easy doing that. And then you pull and strain something and you can't exercise it anyway now for a couple of months very well. And you're stuck, and then you lose interest in going through that again, and so you just get out of the habit of doing strength-building exercise. And then once you're out of the habit of it, of course, your muscles start to atrophy a little bit because muscles are very metabolically expensive to maintain. And if you don't use them, then your body breaks them down and redistributes the proteins elsewhere in your body because it figures that something else must need them more than the muscles that aren't being used. At any rate, what this study showed is that if you lift about 30% of what you could lift in one lift, which isn't very hard to lift, but you do it about 25 times, meaning it's a weight that after about 25 repetitions, you really can't do it anymore. It's kind of like 25 push-ups. But, I mean, we're just talking like weights here. So instead of lifting something 5 to 10 times, you find a weight that you can lift 25 times, but now you're out of energy. Well, they used very sophisticated gene mapping science here and showed quite clearly that the lifting of 30% of your maximum for as many repetitions until you get tired was far superior for activating anabolic or muscle-building protein synthesis the next day compared to the heavier, more injury-prone style of building muscle. And so I think this is very good news for people because it means that you can lift much lighter weights, just do them till you're more tired, tire your muscles out, but at least you know when you can stop and so on. You're much less likely to injure yourself lifting lighter weights. And, of course, make sure you have adequate dietary protein if you're doing this on a regular, consistent basis so that you have the raw materials to build muscle. Of course, muscle is a type of body tissue. It's not just protein. It's made of things like glucosamine, hyaluronic acid, MSM sulfur, or other cofactor nutrients. You want enough nutrients. Sometimes you need some extra iron, especially if you're a vegetarian. But you want enough nutrients working together along with your proteins and your exercise so that you actually notice you're building muscle strength and your body just feels more vibrantly fit. You're just trying to send a message, especially as you get older, around your body that, hey, we're needed, we're being used, we're alive, we're awake. You're not trying out for the Olympics, generally speaking, and what you're just trying to do is keep your body regenerating and rejuvenating itself. When you do that sort of strength training exercise, you condition the muscles, the signal, the release of growth hormone, which works not only for your muscles, but for general anti-aging. It's the best way to get it. You really don't want to take growth hormone. You see these ads, you know, for growth hormone. You really don't want to do that to yourself because, you know, growth hormone has to work in the context. So if the context is that you're stimulating your muscles, you'll release it anyway. If you're not stimulating your muscles and you're taking it, then it could confuse your insulin and actually cause cancer to grow or cause you to become diabetic. So unlike the little ads that show Hercules in the ad because they took growth hormone, that's a bunch of crock. That's not going to anti-age you. It's going to pro-disease you. So the way to get growth hormone to anti-age you is to release it with muscle strength building exercise. This applies to women and men. And here we have very good news that lighter weights, more repetitions, just induce muscle fatigue, but in a much easier to control manner and much less prone to injury, is very, very effective for stimulating this regeneration function in your body, which of course goes along with aerobic exercise. But this is a great study. All right, zinc produces superior eggs for healthy children. Well, we know that various nutrients are needed. I've known zinc, of course, as zinc's involved with a couple hundred enzymes in your body, many of which have to do with reproductive health. We've known the efficiency of sperm, for example, is zinc-dependent. But this is a very interesting study because they were able to look at eggs and using this sophisticated technology. It's just kind of mind-boggling what they can measure these days. They were able to measure the accumulation of zinc ions in ovaries as they went through the maturation process and found out that ovaries love zinc compared to any other mineral. They just love zinc. And in fact, if you don't have zinc, the ovary doesn't mature properly or at an optimal rate, which would make it a healthy egg, which is most likely then to form a healthy fetus, which is then most likely to have a healthy child. So this was proven conclusively, which is very good news, but it does mean that women need to have zinc. Somewhat sobering study that I also report on here is that without adequate zinc, the proper development of the kidneys does not take place in the womb, and you end up with kidneys that are functionally impaired, but they're not functionally impaired enough early in life to raise blood pressure and triglycerides and cause the metabolic syndrome. But as a person gets older and other factors of metabolism become inefficient, then these weak kidneys that were a gift of a birth due to zinc deficiency during pregnancy, now they start to cause blood pressure problems, high triglycerides, and induce poor kidney function. This was documented in an animal study, and of course taking zinc as an adult seems to help somewhat in terms of reducing the triglycerides, but it doesn't really restore the kidney function because you actually didn't develop kidneys during the developmental phase. So you're stuck with a weak link in your chain because mom didn't know to be zinc sufficient. So 15 milligrams of zinc is all it takes a day. Any woman should be doing this prior to pregnancy, during lactation. When 15 milligrams is another recent study, 15 milligrams of zinc a day, the children had much better muscle development and growth development at ages 4 months and 12 months, and a much better ability to thrive. So zinc, which I've always called the survival mineral, because that seems to be what it's linked to, is very important to reproduction and health for both men and women. I've given zinc, as I've said here, to women and men trying to conceive but having some struggles, and I give it to both of them, by the way. But in most cases, of fertility issues, or in a lot of cases, fertility issues are resolved with zinc supplementation, and this is science that shows why. An egg cannot properly mature in the presence of zinc deficiency. And even if it matures enough to become to have a pregnancy, if the zinc deficiency persists throughout the pregnancy and the lactation period, it can have very detrimental effects for that child's future health. So like folic acid and the acidophilus we talked about last week, zinc is yet another nutrient, along with B vitamins in general, that is just critically essential for optimum genetic potential for future health and well-being. And in our society in America here, there's absolutely no excuse for someone being zinc deficient, except that the FDA doesn't tell women who are pregnant that they should absolutely for sure have zinc, and without it, they're in big, big trouble. So I'm telling you that, and hopefully you'll pass the message around to other women, you know, if not yourself. Maybe you know someone who's thinking of becoming pregnant, or you have a daughter or a son who's going to be raising a family here. Some of these tips can make a huge difference in them having healthy children. Okay, linking your brain, inflammation, social stress, and disease risk. Well, this is really becoming an interesting topic to me. I've always been interested in the field of psychoneuroimmunology. I've been a student of the field for more than 20 years. I find it quite fascinating, looking at different behavioral correlates. And the whole idea here, we're moving past just, you know, a person's, say, specific emotions, and we're looking at human organisms, or human beings, you might say, as part of a social network, and what that means to their health. And here we have some studies showing, these done at UCLA, showing that those in socially stressful situations do indeed increase inflammatory markers, and especially upon rejection, different regions of the brain are activated that are associated with both the inflammatory markers and the rejection, meaning that the mind, which can have a perception of feeling left out or not part of, or being, you know, eliminated from a social connection for some reason or another, is more stressed and has more struggles and more inflammation. And I think this is some science that shows why being socially connected in some way, shape, or form is associated with a 50% risk reduction in mortality. That's dramatic, by the way. That's better than exercise, which is kind of hard for me to believe, but it is, as a stat. It's far better than any drug. And so we're seeing that maybe we are what you might call social, or supposed to be social. Now, it doesn't mean you have to join every club there is, but it means you should have some connections, whether it's with your spouse, your family, your church, your friends, your work, your community. Get involved. Do something. Be part of something. Because apparently it's big in terms of your health and what it means. So more science on this. I'm sure we haven't heard the last of it. But very clear links between your brain function, how you process things, and the consequent inflammation. So while we have many causes for inflammation that result in potential wear and tear and accelerated aging and the diseases of aging, one of the things that buffers you from these stressors is your ability to stay socially connected. And in fact, in one of the studies I also quote in this post, it was with women who were pregnant. And they found that even more so than, you know, the social network of a woman, if it was good, could even offset mental health issues and economic distress. It could offset the stress of those. It was more powerful. The positive of the social network was able to offset a lot of disadvantaged type stress, which, again, is quite remarkable. So this is not to be just blown off as, oh yeah, it's nice to have friends. It's maybe nice to make an effort to be more connected to things, because just maybe it will help your health. Okay. Lactoferrin helps bone building and reduces bone loss. Well, lactoferrin is a signaling protein that is typically in mother's milk, first milk colostrum. That's where you find extremely high amounts of it because lactoferrin is needed to guide the immunological evolution of a newborn baby's digestive tract and the immune responses. Without lactoferrin active in this situation, it could be quite distressful. So we see it higher in these type of things. And so milk has a little bit of, you know, just dairy milk has a little bit of lactoferrin, but whey protein has a lot of it. Some of the filtered whey protein products have lots of it. And of course, first milk colostrum would have it as well as you can get purified lactoferrin. And these things offer some distinct advantages, of course, to the immune system, to maintaining a friendly balance of power in your digestive tract, which is, of course, incredibly important. But here we see that it's involved with bone building. And so there's a whole body of science that's evolving here that says lactoferrin. And I might add, just, you know, even though we're talking about it here in the context of newborns, you produce lactoferrin your entire life. It's in your saliva. It's in your tears. It has to be in your saliva if you've got it, because then it goes into your digestive tract and helps protect you. So it's part of your natural immune response when you chew food. You don't know what could be in that food. You might have germs. You might have whatnot. So if you chew it well, you get saliva on it. Part of what's in your saliva, if you have it, is lactoferrin. So it's a natural thing to have your whole life, although you could run low on it. And here we're seeing that's very good for bones. Well, of course, a little newborn baby has got to do rapid bone growth and needs help, so it's not surprising that a compound that's needed also for immunity does double duty here and also goes over and helps bones and helps bone building. So we can take and extrapolate that information and apply it to older age and use lactoferrin as yet another tool for bone building, because the science shows that it, like many other things, but it is another nutrient that helps to stimulate the osteoblasts, which are your bone building carpenters, and it helps to dampen or reduce the number of osteoclasts, which are the remodeling cells that take down bone. And of course, as you get older, one of the biggest problems is an imbalance between osteoblasts, not enough of them or not enough working well, and osteoclasts, which have gone wild and are doing too much tearing down. So lactoferrin is the opposite of that and would be another tool. And it would be especially important for someone who's concerned about bones who also has digestive-related issues, because it's doing, again, double duty. And it's very important. I mean, the science is overwhelmingly clear that lactoferrin is another bone-building, bone-helping nutrient, something for you to keep in your mind, especially if you're someone who is particularly concerned about bones. All right, the last study this week is on chlorella. And this was a very interesting study because they produced in animals, the poor little rats, they always get put into these terrible situations for the benefit of humans, but we should be fortunate we can test some of these things because they actually are quite interesting. And what they did was they caused the little rats to have, they tied up their bile ducts so that the rats became very jaundiced. And when that happens, of course, you get the extra bilirubin building up, and that's very highly inflammatory around the body as well as in the digestive lining. And it's very clear that in these jaundiced conditions, one of the things that happens is you get what's called the leaky gut, and the bacterial toxins translocate from the digestive tract back into the circulation and wreak havoc with your health. We talked about last week how Acidophilus was shown to better that. This is a current study showing how chlorella can prevent that from happening as well. So chlorella is another tool here. Chlorella is found to bind up the bilirubin in the bile and to bind up the bacterial toxins and to help rejuvenate the digestive lining. Spirulina could not do it. That was the other compound tested in the study. But chlorella as a green, chlorella, a single cell, is loaded with RNA. DNA has a high ability to absorb trash, which is one of the reasons I like it as a supplement. I mean, it's just a sponge for toxins and problems. And here, this is clear data showing it can help rejuvenate the, not only prevent the leaky gut, but get, you know, majorly boost the antioxidant defense system back up and reduce the stress of these problems. These are, by the way, even though this is an animal created experiment, the kinds of stressors these animals are being exposed to are not uncommon from someone with digestive imbalance issues. So the data from the study is highly relevant to the human condition, especially if you have digestive problems. Chlorella is highly, highly protective to the lining of your digestive tract. And a good tip for digestive health. Okay, we're going to move now to your questions for the week. See what we have here. First one is from Janice, who says, is there a limit to the amount of acidophilus a person can take? If I take 6 or more capsules a day, I sometimes feel like I'm getting sick. Is that my imagination? Well, no, actually, you probably are getting sick. Acidophilus, friendly flora, as I like to call it, is friendly, but not so often if you take a lot of it, especially if you have a leaky gut. So while acidophilus can help repair the leaky gut, you want to keep the dose down around 2 a day, maybe 4 a day. Now some people can take more, but the bacteria can translocate through the leaky gut and evoke an immune response, and you can actually feel like you're getting sick from acidophilus. This, of course, is a problem for, you know, there's a lot of advice out there on various websites for, you know, when you have little children with learning difficulties or autism spectrum disorders, they're telling them to take high amounts of acidophilus to repair the leaky gut. You can make a little kid really sick doing that, something I would never suggest. I'm just bringing it up here because, unfortunately, it's being done. You want to keep the dose moderate. You want to keep it relatively low, but it's very, very helpful. But it's not your imagination, Janice. Stick to 2 a days, and if you want to, you can try 4 a day. Sometimes it helps, sometimes it doesn't. But make sure you know that you feel better on a higher dose. Just don't start taking a bunch of it. I think lower dose acidophilus, 1 or 2 capsules a day, is great, very helpful for many things, and that's where I keep it. Bill says, I've developed diarrhea several months ago and I can't get it to stop. My gut feels tight and painful. I've tried all kinds of germ killers and even tried various parasite products and nothing seems to work. Do you have any ideas what could be causing this? Generally, Bill, when you've kind of done the germ killing thing, and a lot of the germ killers, even if they don't say they're for parasites, would probably help. And if you've actually done parasite products, which sometimes helps diarrhea, and they're not, then it's usually not a germ that's causing it. It's usually a spasm in your digestive tract, which would be consistent with a tight and painful feeling. And, of course, there is one miracle remedy for this. It's called peppermint oil. You want enteric-coated peppermint. I used to make that product, but we just didn't have enough demand for it. But we do keep it at our office, so you can just call our office, and we'll send you out some enteric-coated peppermint. But it normally will stop diarrhea within a day or two because it relaxes the spasm in your digestive tract, and that's what I do. And generally, if someone calls in with this kind of an issue, we give them the GI soother first because it's so relaxing to your digestive tract anyway. It kind of, you know, to me, the GI soother is the modern day Pepto-Bismol. It's what you give for a stomach ache or a little unknown complaint. I mean, it will get rid of almost anything. Sometimes it will stop diarrhea beautifully. But a lot of times in your situation, you'll never get it to stop, Bill, until you get the spasm to stop. And interestingly, nothing is superior to peppermint oil in this situation. It is a true wonder of a remedy. Harriet, is there anything I can do for the brown spots on my skin? I've heard them referred to as age spots. Why do they happen? Well, you get what is called lipofuscin forming, and they're basically odd-chain fatty acids that normally fatty acids are metabolized in twos, and you get these damaged fats building up in cells, and it's called lipofuscin. They're odd carbon fatty acids. They can be induced, of course, from sun damage or oxidative damage, where the fat is damaged by the radiation from the sun, which is why they often happen in skin areas that have been exposed to the sun. But they can happen anywhere. They're called age spots. They're also called liver spots. In fact, if you were to go into your brain, where you have memory impairment, you'll find these all over the fat in the brain, and they happen in the liver as well. So while you see them under your skin, they can happen elsewhere. So, in order to metabolize an odd chain fatty acid out of something, you need a compound called acetyl L-carnitine. It is the only thing I know that helps get rid of them. Sometimes it works to the point is of remarkable, and other times it doesn't seem to phase the problem. I'd say it's about 50-50, Harriet, that you can clear out some of these age spots or get them to lighten with acetyl L-carnitine. Of course, acetyl L-carnitine is so good for you for many reasons that just taking it in general never hurt anybody, but you know, you may find, I've seen it happen. They've conducted studies on it. It's been shown to help age spots, and you know, it's, you know, not a miracle, but it is potentially helpful. And of course, the increased formation of them signifies an overall lack of antioxidants in the first place. So if you boost up your antioxidant bank account, you may be less prone to forming them, and that actually might help to get rid of them as well, because if your acetyl L-carnitine is clearing them out, but the condition of your body is such that you're just making more of them because you're deficient in antioxidants, that's maybe why you don't see the result all the time. But a combination of antioxidants and acetyl L-carnitine would be a good approach to try and see how far it gets you. Jesse says, I'm 24, not overweight, and I have ugly cellulite that started after my child, and I can't get rid of it. Can nutrition help this problem? Well, cellulite, especially when you're not overweight, there's several things going on. One, you generally have excessive estrogenic activity going on. You might have noticed after your child, especially when your menstrual cycles start back up again, they're heavier, they're different, something's going on with them. But that would be one thing, meaning you don't have enough progesterone relative to your estrogen. This usually happens, from stress, from the wear and tear, from not sleeping, from demands on you. You use up your progesterone, it creates a relative imbalance. So extra estrogen keeps stimulating connective tissue in that area of your body, and then the tissue that's stimulated forms irregularly, and that's how it happens at your age and what you're dealing with. So, you know, kind of the thing that's punching the structure in the nose is the extra estrogen, and you want to work on that. You can use products like Female Plus or even Profem Cream to help balance your menstrual cycle. Anything that helps stress, helps you feel more energy, more relaxed, will actually help because it supports your adrenal glands. Nutrients like pantothene, vitamin C, B complex, they're all really good. And can help that aspect of it. Now, as far as the localized aspect of it, I find that you might be able to clear out some of this damaged tissue with enzymes. I like Repair Plus that has the bromelain. I think that's very good. You can help with the fluid and circulation issues with the Cardio Helper product. Of course, you don't want to get constipated. I mean, you're not really giving much here about your history, but any kind of constipation or sluggish lymph problems will back this up into your legs and make it worse. But, you know, a strategy of, say, Cardio Helper, Repair Plus, and then things that boost your adrenals, that would be, and balance your estrogen, essentially. That's what I would focus on, and I think you'll see some change and improvement in terms of where this problem is for you. There is no miracle cure, but it can be managed, and I've seen it improve dramatically. You just got to get the right combination for yourself, Jesse. John says, my right hip is painful and sometimes the pain extends down my leg. I hate sitting or driving in the car for any length of time. My doctor calls it sciatica and has prescribed pain medication that I don't like. What would you suggest? John, you of course want to stretch that leg out. You want to maybe use an inversion table to take stress off the bottom of your discs. You can maybe even need a chiropractic adjustment or something. You'd be surprised. There's a lot of physical therapy and these kind of alternative things that help with the structural lineup in your lower back, which is where the problem actually is, generally. And then, The nutrients that help sciatica the most is magnesium and what I found is calcium AEP. So sometimes I'll use a product that's called Daily Builder, and that's all you need. Other times I'll also add extra calcium AEP to that, and up to 6 a day of each, and you can usually get it to be a lot better. And then you stay on whatever dose starts making it feel better for a good 2 months. And then it usually heals up, and so that if you don't then have a structural problem that's constantly irritating it, that should take care of it and get you out of that. Maybe you find you need some of these nutrients regularly, especially if you're also working with some adjustments or doing something. But it's usually triggered, John, by a structural issue from some reason or another, an old injury, an accident, whatever. And now there's some compression on the nerve going down, the long sciatic nerve. That's why your doctor's calling it sciatica. And you want to address this. You want to take care of it. You shouldn't have to be like this in most situations. It's quite fixable unless you have some structural abnormality that can't be corrected. But you want to get the nerve out of inflammation. There's lots of things you can do besides what I just said, but those are the basics that usually work. June says, I sometimes have indigestion, but I never know when I will have it, and I can't trace it to any food. Sometimes it seems like the only thing I notice is I'm tired, and then I get it. Would digestive enzymes help me? Well, you actually gave me the key clue here, June. You're tired, and then you get it. Digestion actually takes about one-third of your energy. So the ability to concentrate enzymes in your stomach and pancreas and so on requires a tremendous amount of energy. And so when you're tired, you don't have the energy to make digestive enzymes, and thus you eat food, and the acid-alkali components of the food chemically react, make gas, make bloating, make indigestion. Digestive enzymes would absolutely help you in this situation. You can even take them only when you need them, meaning if you know you're tired, you can take two or three of, say, Digestive Helper before a meal, and you'll generally have the extra digestive power you need so that you don't get the indigestion. Or you can even, when you just happen to say, oh, I've got indigestion, you can take the enzymes. Now, I usually start out with Digestive Helper. Sometimes we'll go to some extra hydrochloric acid if needed. I don't usually start out with that. Usually Digestive Helper takes care of it. This is what I call a simple case indigestion, and your cause of it is very clear. You just don't have energy. So again though, sleeping better would help. Nutrients that help make energy would help, because the more energy you have, the better. So usually you're in some kind of wear and tear or something. So, you know, your basic multiple vitamin, maybe some Panathene or Q10, adrenal support, you know, just things that help your energy better, because that's obviously, then you have the extra energy you need so as to digest food, which then, of course, gets more energy into your body. So it creates a healthy catch-22 instead of a fatigued catch-22 where you can't digest the food to get the energy, and then because you don't have the energy to digest the food, which is what digestive enzymes help in the what I call the simple case. But that sounds like what your situation is, and that should take care of it for you, June. Okay, that's it for your questions this week. If you have a question, please email it to me, askbyron@wellnessresources.com. Have a great and healthy week. I'll be back next week with another podcast bringing you the news and, of course, more of your questions. Take care. Have a great week.
The Weekly Wellness Update podcast is produced by Wellness Resources Incorporated. All rights reserved. For more information on the topics and news covered in today's podcast, visit wellnessresources.com. To email Byron a specific health question, send it to askbyron@wellnessresources.com. The information presented in this podcast is for informational purposes. It is not medical advice for the treatment of any condition or illness. You should not use the information in this podcast for diagnosis or treatment of any health problem or to discontinue the use of any medication that has been prescribed to you. Consult your physician or healthcare professional for such needs. Statements made during this podcast regarding any Wellness Resources dietary supplement products have not been evaluated by the FDA. Wellness Resources dietary supplement products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.